This is The Hard Question on WCGO. Here's BQ.
Many of us are trying to figure out what the president is actually doing, pulling the troops out of Syria. Are we concerned about prisoners that are ISIS prisoners that may be released? And actually, there's a lot of details in the mix there. I think the Pentagon just can't quite figure their own strategy. But I like to always talk to our very dear friend of the show, Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel. He saw incredibly, well, intense combat in the Middle East as a Special Operations Forces soldier. And after he retired, he continues to advise the Assyrian Christian Army in Iraq. You know, but Sargis, it's important to figure out what in the world is going on.
Hey, Blanquita, it's good to be here. It's just a process. Foreign policy is not an easy thing to figure out, but as long as you look at long-term strategy, I think you're going to come out at the end a winner.
But, you know, I'm looking at it from the point of view, the press is saying things that basically a lot of even Republicans who have sort of supported the president, they are rejecting this. And you have Turkey that's saying that the threats from the president amid conflicting signals over the Syrian offensive they're really getting angry as well. Can you explain the scenario, or from what you understand, that you think that the president is trying to accomplish here?
I think the president's focused on what is important for the United States in the long run within the region. I think all the issues are coming up in discussions, regardless of which side of the aisle you're from or which agency you're operating within. You have to look at it from where is the United States going to be 10, 20 years from now. And as far as this process is concerned, we had looked at these maturations even going back to 2015, where we literally looked at the relationship we had with the Kurdish populace, both in Syria and Iraq. And I remember one of the articles that we wrote, which was March of 2016, I believe, on the Near East side, was that the Kurds will take DOD monies support, but their hearts belong to their first love, which is the Russians. And this has always existed as a reality going back to the 60s. We've had a relationship with the Kurds for now almost half of a century. Our operational requirements came in when we first went into Iraq during the first Iraq war. In the 90s, we established a no-fly zone to protect the Kurds. In the process of doing that, within the Kurdish factions themselves, between the Barzani and the Jalal Talabani, they had thousands of killed fighting internal fights. We did bring them to the table. We told them that they need to work together. And in the process of guiding them, they were able to even get a regional government.
Tell us a little bit, Sargis. When we talk about the Kurds, Sargis, you know, I know that all of the time, how much time you have years spent with in the Middle East, but to explain to the audience the significance of who the Kurds are, they're a little bit of their history so that, that folks understand.
Well, the Kurds are a tribal faction that migrated into the regions that they are currently. So they came from Afghanistan. They migrated to Iran. They established on the borders and the historically between Iran and Iraq. And like I said, once we started providing our Air Force as their Air Force, giving the backing in the 90s, protecting them, they started expanding their footprint in areas that they would have never imagined they could have expanded to an extent where we're the ones who enabled them to have a regional government. Now, the Kurds sit in Turkey, in Iran, in Iraq, in Syria. And the unfortunate issue for the Kurds is, based on their leadership, they're still tribal. They have a lot of internal fightings. The Kurds of Iran are currently conducting attacks into Iraq. The Kurds of Iraq are supporting the Turks to knock out the Kurds that are from Syria, who are part of PKK, that are currently operating out of some of the northern villages in Iraq. The Kurds in Syria are not friends to the Kurds in Iraq. So it's an issue that they have internally. And this regional issue, this local issue that it existed within the Kurds, where they have killed each other to the thousands, to enough thousands, is I think why the current POTUS stated that it just doesn't make sense for us to be committed in a long, enduring partnership that from the other side is not seen as a long enduring partnership.
So well, see, Sergius, that's important to explain because, you know, it's different when you know all the information, but when you have a country that doesn't understand that they're fighting themselves, the whole idea of this tribal infighting, and who are we really standing with? And some people are saying that we are not supporting the Kurds. This is terrible that, you know, we were there to help them. They don't understand. And frankly, I didn't understand all the significance of this infighting, which is pretty lethal when they are in countries who are not necessarily friendly to us. The other issue I wanted to talk to you about, Sargis, is Turkey. And I understand that Erdogan is going to be coming to the United States. I don't know if he'll actually eventually come, but I went to Turkey back around 2008. And I've always been a great admirer of Ataturk, who was their Lincoln. And the idea that it was more democratic and the women didn't have to wear hijabs and he wanted separation of church and state. But now, after all these generations, you've got Erdogan, who I feel is going backwards. And I don't know if that's going to reflect a change in the way they treat the United States. What are your thoughts?
Well, look, that's the reality of the struggles that exist within all the Muslim countries that are in the Middle East. They will always have this issue. Iraq is based on an Islamic constitution. At the end of the day, the hadiths and the Sharia law are the main guiding factors for these nations. And I think this is one of the issues sometimes my friends in the Pentagon don't understand when it comes to even the Sunni Muslim Kurds. You know, they say, well, they're much more broader in their thinking than any other Muslim nation or a group within their region. But the reality is, in Iran, women used to wear miniskirts. They used to be at the beaches in bikinis. In a short amount of time, they went to the hijab, reason being because the main guiding factor of the Islamic Republic was still based on the supremacy of the Islamic law and the rule, which is the mandate and the dictate that drives how those nations have to progress. Turkey is no different, regardless of how modern it might be. It might be at the crossroads of the two nations. That's an internal issue that Islam has to figure out, and that's why these maturations
But that's the trouble. You see, that's the trouble. And the sad thing is, I was when I was listening to you talk about, you know, I remember that time and the 60s, and you had the Shah, and it was very modern, and it flipped. The Shah went to Texas. He was ill. I remember all of that. But, you know, you think if you had a time machine and you went back and you could visit Iran at that time, you know, it would make you cry to think that it was going to change. It was going to turn around. It was going to not be the same. And that's kind of the feeling I had. You know, I went into Hagia Sophia, and that beautiful church that had been Constantine influenced by his mother, the first Christian church. But on the walls where they have all those gorgeous mosaics and pictures of Christ, and it's just gorgeous. It's huge. But on the walls they have, there is no God but Allah. So it's fascinating because in a way, you know, most people couldn't understand that, but I think it's subtle, but you feel the change coming and it could impact us in this country sincerely, because that's like one of the few republics.
Well, look, it's just a reality. I mean, the ISIS operators that are currently in prison, the ones who fought on the battlefield that are in Syria, which most of our congressmen are saying, if you abandon the battlefield, they're going to be let go. Well, if you're a Kurdish soldier who's protecting him or securing him in their prisons, why would you let him out if you truly are against the type of operations they conduct? If you go back and take a look at where ISIS originated, where it started functioning, it's all been in the Kurdish administered areas, both in Syria and in northern Iraq. Majority of the Kurdish clergymen who were in their council of elders when it came to their spiritual council, put a better term, actually joined ISIS, supported ISIS operations. Turkey in itself funded ISIS.
We're going to come back with you, Sargis, because we'll take a little break. You know how fast it goes when you're on the program. And I'm Blanquita Cullum. This is The Hard Question here on WCGO in Chicago. Don't forget to listen to us on SoundCloud. Thank you to our wonderful sponsor, John Lester. Lester Insurance. It's lesterinsure1.com.
This is The Hard Question on WCGO. Here's BQ.
Attacking to retired Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari, I was looking at an article, and we were talking about these Kurdish fighters that have been warning that Turkey's Syrian invasion might allow ISIS to attempt these mass prison breaks. And they said that there are more than 15,000 ISIS fanatics currently jailed in northeast Syria as Turkey plans to have the cross-border military operation. Well, Sargis, you said that why would they let them out? But the fact of the matter is, again, it could be money. It could be some special operation. If there's nobody keeping an eyeball on what's going on, they could break out. And what would that mean to us?
Well, look, Turkey knows who these individuals are. And where the tie is between Turkey and the Kurds out of Syria, who they're fighting against, but the Kurds in Iraq who they're working with, is the fact that, look, when we went in initially and our Delta operators, I was making a point last time, killed Abu Sayyaf, and this took place, the strike against him was in May of 2015. We found out that Abu Sayyaf was selling ISIS oil, and that ISIS oil was being put on trucks in Syria. It was going through the Kurdish-administered areas. It was making its way into Iraq under the Kurdish-administered supervision. It was moving into Turkey. Turkey was selling it for $20 a barrel on the cheap to the Europeans for a benefit. Part of what Turkey was doing was taking that money also and spending it, giving it to these so-called ISIS fighters that didn't magically appear in Syria suddenly.
Right.
They landed in Turkey, and they walked through that border, open border, that Turkey allowed to be open for its wants and desires to affect what it thought was going to be a regional expansion for a future caliphate that Erdogan saw himself as being the sultan. So the Kurdish, Sunni Muslim Kurds on both sides of that border, Syria and Iraq, benefited financially even from ISIS oil and operations. We have, as the United States...
So in other words, what you're saying, when you say that, when you're saying they benefited from that, Sargis, is that you're saying that they were on the take?
Well, these are open source documents that they were benefiting from that oil sales. When you allow trucks full of oil move through your borders, that's a lot of money that is being moved. Today, the main fight in Iraq is where the uprising is a internal fight also between the Kurds in Iraq and also the Iraqi government trying to account for all the oil barrels that are still not being accounted for that are flowing out of Erbil.
And where are they going? Are they going into Turkey for Turkey's own use, or are they going to other countries? Are they going to Saudi Arabia? Are they going to Europe? Are they just going to Middle East? Where is the oil going to?
During the time that ISIS was operating in the Kurdish-administered areas, it was going up north. Today it's going down south. I'm not going to get into which countries are benefiting from it, but at least you can see that things have changed with ISIS being on the ground and not on the ground. The oil still flows. It still supports some of these operations. Look, the first anniversary article that we wrote for the Near East concentrated on how Turkey was using the refugees as a new means to be able to literally put the EU under a sanction requirement from their perspective to do the beating that it wanted within the region.
I mean, to do their bidding, what did that mean? What bidding did they want them to do?
Let us into the EU or give us money. And they flipped it for money. Millions of refugees ended up in Europe because Turkey opened up the border, just like they opened up the border, allowing all these fighters that are ISIS fighters going into Turkey. Turkey knows each and every one of those fighters that are in those camps.
Let me share something with you, Sargis. This is what the vice president of Turkey said on Tuesday. He said, when it comes to the security of Turkey, as always our president emphasized, Turkey will determine its own path. First, he said in a speech that he referred to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who's vowed to create a safe zone in a lengthy swath of Syrian territory along Turkey's borders. Well, people are afraid with the bad reputation of ISIS and the idea that they have brutal killers. You know, look, we went through 9/11. We've had a lot of incidents of terrorism and terrorism in areas that we don't want to happen. in the Middle East or in our country, any other local location. I mean, come on, we opened up Guantanamo Bay. So I think a lot of people legitimately are worried about these guys getting out.
Well, they shouldn't get out. If they get out, it's Turkey's fault. Turkey's only
doesn't
one
matter. It doesn't matter. If they get out, they get out. Who's? I mean, after you can point the blame, it doesn't matter. I mean, should the president sit there and negotiate tougher with him, or is Turkey going to be basically saying that his country wouldn't react to threats as it prepares to mount a military offensive against the U.S. allied Kurdish fighters in Syria?
Look, if Turkey decided to go in and kill the Kurds in Syria, just like they're killing the Kurds right now with bombing campaigns for the past 2 weeks in northern Iraq. In Iraq, we consider Iraq as being American-held territory, okay? But Kurds are dying. The Kurds of PKK are dying in Assyrian villages, which they have occupied by the bombing campaign that the Kurds are, Turks are conducting with the support of the Kurds that belong to Barzani that are against the PKK. So this is a problem again. We cannot be involved from the U.S. strategically in the long run in these fights. And I think the POTUS understands that. What we have to do is make sure that our folks at the in the Pentagon and our folks that are sitting in Congress understand you have to have a strategic vision of where you want to go. You're not going to be able to unravel these internal maturations and fights that take place between these nations. Turkey is a NATO ally.
Do you think, Sargis, that there's a problem in that? I see it happening even in South America. We look at all the different little countries in there. I don't care whether it's Honduras or Nicaragua, Panama, whether you go over to Venezuela or Chile or Argentina or any of the places in Ecuador. We don't understand the Middle East differences of the countries and the fights that they have within themselves, because in many cases, they're trying to kill each other more than they're trying to kill us.
And they are, and they don't have a goal. If they had a goal, a universal goal, then we could support them. But if tomorrow I go and make the Kurd who's a PKK happy, the Barzani Kurd is angry. If I make the Barzani Kurd happy, the Jalal Talabani Kurd is angry. These individuals will never work together. We have done whatever we can into the billions of dollars to get them to even have an administered region, and the administered regions be turned over to them. The only thing that happened in those regions is ISIS continued operations. Things that, as far as protection of the minorities, never manifested itself. The infighting between the Arabs and the Kurds became large, and then it was before, to a point where right now, since 2003, $410 billion are missing out of the coffers of the Iraqi government. The Iraqi government makes 3.1 million barrels of oil. It has 38 million people within its borders, and it cannot even put food on the plates of its people.
All right, so let me ask you this. This is important.
Fighting tribalism.
All right, so let me ask you, so then why do they follow them? Why do they, if they can't put food on the table in their countries and of their people, why do you have this massive group of people continuing to keep ISIS alive? Why do they do that? That just, I don't understand that.
Because ISIS is an ideology. You could call it ISIS today. Before you called it Iraq AQ. You called it Al Qaeda prior to that. It is an ideology that has existed there for 2,000 years, and this ideology even exists in the borders of Europe and has crossed over to our borders, our open borders here in the United States. These are, for the past 7 years, at a minimum, you have close to 200 individuals who were arrested that came from these ISIS areas where ISIS was operating. A lot of them had seen combat on the battlefield, and they're coming to our borders in the south.
So, well, yeah, they are. And ISIS, what they're doing, Sargis, and this I know for sure, because, you know, I've lived in Texas, and I'm very close with a lot of people in the immigration and a lot of the judges that are still in places like San Antonio. And they tell me that what happens is that they try to come across the border and the southern borders, and they will try to change your names to Garcia, Gomez, Longoria, whatever, to be able to be perceived as being a Hispanic as opposed to being, let's say, someone from the Middle East. We're going to take a break. We've got this great guest. I want to find out more about what's happening in the latest with Sargis Sangari, who is a retired U.S. Army colonel. He's going to find about his articles, but I want to find out what's going on with Saudi Arabia. He knows everything. He's so bright. This is A Hard Question on WCGO. Don't forget to listen to us in SoundCloud. John Lester Insurance. He can handle every kind of insurance with a great price. 888-3809-059. 3809-059. We'll be back.
This is The Hard Question on WCGO.
Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari is a retired U.S. Army colonel, and he was in the Middle East seeing a lot of extensive combat as a special operation forces soldier. But what's interesting to me, I mean, I just found this out, that he immigrated to the United States back in 1980 at the age of 10 after the Iranian Revolution. And Sargis, you know, we cover so much every time you get on the show. We got to go back a little bit here to Saudi Arabia. And so how is Saudi Arabia going to be affected with what's happening right now in Turkey, et cetera? What are your thoughts?
Well, Saudi Arabia is dysfunctional at best. It's like any other Sunni state. And I hate to tell you, Turkey was probably going to suffer the same fate after its operations in Syria and Iraq. The Sunni states are not proving themselves capable of being able to do anything against the rising Shia menace, which is Iran within the region. Part of the reason is because Iran, for the past 40 years, has had a concept of how it wants to expand its footprint and regional capabilities, be able to be a hegemon, regional hegemon, to be the leader of Islam. And Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Egypt, internally and geographically, have shown that they're not capable of getting there.
So are you saying they have weak leadership? I mean, or is it, Saudi Arabia has always seemed, I don't know, the thing that you said the last time was that Saudi Arabia is not strong. They'd have to go out and hire an army. But at least they have the money to hire the army. These other countries, I'm not necessarily sure that Turkey could pull it together.
No, the Sunni leadership has shown they're more tribal than anything else, whether it be a Sunni Muslim Kurd or Arab from Saudi Arabia. They are tribal in their mentalities.
Would you explain that to the audience, Sargis, because you know what it means, but what does that mean, the tribal mentality? What does that mean?
They never were an established nation state that created itself internally. The Persian, as an example, established his own empire internally, expanded that empire before he ever became Muslim. The tribal Bedouin, who was put in charge of these nations that were carved out by the British and the French as a Sykes-Picot agreement, which was a contractual agreement that was going to end in 100 years, really was given the state. Same thing that we tried to do even with some of these tribal groups, like we say the Sunni Muslim Kurds, we gave them an amnesty to the region, but they were tribal. They don't know how to operate these things. A nation like Iran, although it's Islamic, although it uses Islam as a terrorist operational need for its benefit of the expansion of its state and protection of its regime, does not think the same way that these tribal groups do. That's why it's able to, even within these Sunni states, get the Shiites that are Arab to be so focused on the end state, which for them is an expansion of the Iranian state requirements throughout the region.
Okay, so that explains a lot. Now, my next question is, given that explanation, who would you say is the most important leader in the Middle East, or the most important country that the United States should be concerned about and trying to deal with any kind of diplomacy or caution? We know Iran has nuclear capability. What are your thoughts?
Well, the problem is you have to work with all of them, but I think the only one that has been able to bring anybody to the table was Iran. Iran think about it, sat across the table from the rest of the national security, UN Security Council countries, and struck a nuclear deal with them. As much as it was a bad deal for us, and the current POTUS has tried to change those terms, Iran is still able to try to strike those deals or a future deal for the benefit of its capabilities and the protection of its regime. Now, with that said, I don't know if any of the Sunni states are capable internally to generate that type of a focus for their nation states to be able to strike deals in the future. What happens is they end up becoming, we call them like the leaf. Every time you blow the wind in a different direction, they move to a different direction. Look, I'll give you a perfect example of this, and I don't want to pile up on the Kurds on this, but these are the realities. You know, in March 2016, Defense Secretary Ash Carter had testified on a proposal of what the fiscal year 2017 budget was going to look like. And when he talked about that, he specifically spoke on the strategic concepts of the list of the countries that we have to worry about. And the list contains Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, and terrorism as the five evolving strategic challenges that the Department of Defense was planning its budget around in 2017. Shortly after he made that announcement, at that time, Mr. Murad, who's the Secretary of the Central Council for the Patriotic Kurdistan Union, PUK, met with the Russian ambassador. And he told them that the KRG, he told them that the Kurds in Iraq, Syria, and Turkey are allies of Russia. This is a problem with these tribal mentalities. Today, you're not there to go to the other person. This is how they operate. You need to have somebody who might not be an enduring partner to you, but you have to be able to consistently work with them.
Sargis, let me ask you what you're working on and how people can get your articles, because you're such a great writer. And you have a lot of different takes on China, et cetera. How can they find out what you've been writing and where do they go?
They could go to the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement. I do write. I have written before for Western Free Press and the Daily Herald. There were a number of articles I wrote about China and our U.S. approach strategically against China. The most recent one that is going to come out is an article that is looking at why is it that with all the China is doing to its Muslim populations and how it's suppressing them. The genocide is being done against the Rohingyas in China, being led by Chinese companies, is not being challenged by the various different Sunni states, as you mentioned, given the fact they have all agreements with China to make
and
sure
those,
that
and those Uyghurs are going to places like Turkey.
Yeah, correct. So they're forcing these Sunni states have an agreement to have China force those type of movements to stay on the ground within their borders and countries. Now,
let me ask you something, Sargis. The other thing is that when I met with the Uyghurs in Turkey, and at that time, you know, they were great. You had some old guys that were coming out wearing their World War II uniforms. They had the United States, and they had served on our side. But from what I understand, that is the issue with the Uyghurs as the way that they've been portrayed in the press out there, that they're iffy, that they may be terrorists, that the China's got this way they have framed it, but they didn't seem like that. And so I mean, is that something that they've tried to create drama around who they are?
And China doesn't want any type of an Islamic movement, whether moderate or non-moderate, within its borders. It believes it to be a destabilizing effect against it, and it tries to ensure that the country that has a relationship, the Sunni states that also benefit from China being in the region, are not affected, given the fact that it will put more pressure on China economically. So this is the reason why China can do whatever it does to these Muslim groups and tribal groups, and you won't hear a peep out of any of the Islamic states, or you won't even hear any type of a peep out of anybody who should be defending what is happening to these minorities.
And so let me ask you then, with the difference now with what's going on, do you think that China will try to play games with Turkey to influence them to get rid of the Uyghurs or turn over the Uyghurs or do something that will compromise their lives and livelihood?
Well, their lives have been compromised, but Turkey is working with Russia right now, which is working with Iran, which is working with China. So there's a economic piece of this too, which is Shanghai Cooperation Organization is implementing through the region.
I can't believe we're out of time. This always happens, Sargis. Sargis Singari, he is one of our favorite guests, Lieutenant Colonel, retired U.S. Army, saw a lot of combat in the Middle East. Thank you for joining us, and thank you all for joining us. We're going to be back tomorrow, and don't forget to go to our great friend, John Lester. If you've got insurance needs, he's going to give you a great deal. LesterInsureOne.com.